You want to know the Stranger Things scene that more than any other scene in the entire show had me freaking out, crawling out of my skin with suspense? It was this scene in season one, where Nancy and Jonathan are searching for the monster that they think killed Barb, and instead they get this jump scare followed by finding this little hole into the Upside Down, and Nancy crawls through on her own, and she is the first of the main characters to voluntarily go into the Upside Down, and then she sees the Demogorgon feeding on the deer that she saw, and she can't find her way out, and she's calling for help, and it is jump out of your skin creepy. Such a good scene. And it's really because the Upside Down in Stranger Things season one was legitimately terrifying. And season five, it's different. It's way, way different. And it's not just desensitization. There's something else major going on here, I think. Something that really reveals what was so brilliant about Stranger Things world building in the first place from the beginning, and how that world building tied into every aspect of the story. And this is a factor that, in my opinion, has steadily declined in quality after season one. And I don't hate Stranger Things after season one. I don't hate this new season. It's had its moments, which we will talk about. But I think the show has lost something important by this point, which is what I want to explore. Okay, so my thesis about the Upside Down in a shocking turn of events does not have to do with the Upside Down. It has to do with a question that I have never heard asked, not in a real way, not in like a story way, which is shocking to me because I think this is like the pivotal question of all of Stranger Things world building. And that is, why the 80s? I feel like we take that for granted with the show. And everyone knows, yes, it is a huge draw, it is a huge selling point, but why? Is it just a gimmick? Does it just have to do with, like, outside the story stuff? Or is this an aspect that the story uses in a more significant way? Could Stranger Things have just as easily taken place in the 60s or the 30s or the 2010s or cowboy times? Would the story have been any different? And no, I don't mean, well, they would have had iPods and horses, not Walkmans and shoulder pads. I mean, like, real differences, story differences. Okay, so you guys all know the drill on this channel. The first rule of analysis, ask what, not why. Why the 80s? No. What are the 80s? Or at least, what are the 80s according to Stranger Things? How does this show use this era? What are they highlighting about it? How are they interpreting it? What are they showing us about it? Well, just starting from the beginning, starting with what we see, we get a very peaceful, comfortable, small-town suburban life. We see this wholesome, idyllic family life. We got a bunch of nerds in the basement playing D&D, having fun. We see the kind of gaudy, innocent 80s fashion. It all seems pretty straightforward. It seems pretty superficial. Except if you stop and look at not just what it is, but how it's used. I want you to compare it to, like, Lord of the Rings, like, the life in the Shire. And we can see pretty immediately that it is not used in that way. It's not like a basis for comparison to the real world, which is full of daring, dangerous adventure, and then the Shire contrasts with that. The Shire is safe. The Shire is where that stuff doesn't belong. No, in Stranger Things, the perfect, wholesome, suburban 80s life, it's almost used as an antagonist. Stranger Things season one is all about characters uncovering something extraordinary and horrifying, and nobody believes them. That is an essential element here. It's not just skepticism, it's that this type of peaceful suburban life, it looks nice, it looks like paradise, everyone is comfortable and affluent and well-groomed, but that's hiding this sense of isolation, which is leading to a lot of quiet suffering that everyone just ignores. The 80s of the Stranger Things is full of social outcasts who are bullied in ways that would just not be tolerated nowadays. But back then, it's open, it's accepted that there are just these nerds that you are allowed to bully and ostracize. People all around the supposedly peaceful neighborhood are struggling with broken family relationships and mental health struggles and drug abuse problems, and you are not allowed to talk about any of it.
Mom does it when she's out of Valium.
And again, it's at a different level of stigma than what we would see today. The same with the way that women are harassed, not taken seriously. Yes, that still happens, but in the 80s, it was overt. It was shameless. No one was even trying to pretend otherwise. Same thing with open homophobia, same with racism. And you look at economics too, and you see how Stranger Things is depicting how these big franchises were taking over, and they were pushing small businesses out. We got the big mall taking jobs, and no one cares. And then the really telling one is families. Ted Wheeler, as always, is just endlessly fascinating to me. He is beyond checked out. He is like a shell of a person. His wife is utterly bored with him. And the kids, we think of this time as like, oh, kids were so independent back then. Kids in the 80s were on their own. This is the heyday of the latchkey kid. And there's a time in America where divorce rates were starting to skyrocket. We got lots of broken homes, loveless marriages, lonely, neglected kids. Kids who did look to fantasy games to escape, to have some light in their lives, some connection. And granted, this stuff is not the most hyper-specific 80s stuff imaginable, but you compare it to like the 60s and the 70s, those were times of social change, social movements. This was the sexual revolution, it was Woodstock, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, it was the hippie era, people were living in communes, there were spiritual awakenings, people were going to India. Christianity and religion on the whole was on the decline in both eras in America. But in the 60s, it was rebellion against religion. It was fighting against it. It was replacing with new forms of spirituality, or replacing with humanism, secularism. This is a time when people were also fighting wars together, or protesting wars together, marching on Washington together, or they were crowding together in local fallout shelters during the Cuban Missile Crisis. The Cold War was at its hottest in this era. And the 80s, by contrast, in all these respects, was a time of apathy. The Cold War was not what it was 20 years ago, not what it was 10 years ago. Vietnam was over, people in the West were kind of moving on in their lives. Yet people not turning away from religion because of mass spiritual movements, it was just losing interest. People were not turning to drugs for transcendental psychedelic experiences that would lead to enlightenment and bring about the new age. They were trying to numb themselves, or they were fighting the numbness by trying to feel anything. They were isolated from their shrinking communities, from their loveless families, from themselves. And they were struggling with this encroaching malaise of meaninglessness that seemed to be turning the whole world into shells of the vibrant humanity that once burned so bright in their parents' generation. These eras of revolution, eras of war that their grandparents came from, now there was nothing to fight, there was no purpose, there's no one to fight with because no one cared. And anyone who did try to fight, anyone who did try to say anything, you're saying you're unhappy? Why? Look at your life. You're comfortable, you got your job, you're going to school, you got all the entertainment you could ask for, the arcade and the movie theater and the mall, sitting in front of the TV with your TV dinner, your toaster pastries. You have all your needs taken care of. This is living. This is the life. So kick back and enjoy yourself and try not to think too much. Stop complaining. You're fine. Look around. Everyone else is fine. It's probably nothing. And yes, I am playing a bit fast and loose with what is precisely the 80s versus how I'm characterizing the 60s and 70s. This is imposing a social commentary to support a narrative. This is not my narrative. This is not how I'm seeing it necessarily. I'm trying to explain how Stranger Things is understanding and interpreting this era of the 80s. And I think Stranger Things is picking up on a real widespread sentiment about this era, that people were isolated and no one was helping them. Those institutions were not developed yet. That social consciousness was not attuned yet, and people were just not interested in doing that anyway. And instead, people were becoming these sedated versions of people. Society was this sedated version of society that pretended to be satisfied with the status quo when really there was this desperate need for meaning and the connection that comes from finding meaning. And the lack of that was causing this severe damage internally, in communities, in families, and especially in the quiet suffering of individuals. And it was damage that no one wanted to acknowledge. Stranger Things season one is not just a story about a mystery in a small town in the 80s. It's about children who are neglected and not listened to. It's about teenage girls who are mistreated and hurt in a world that stays silent. It's about single mothers that people will call crazy. It's about traumatized, grieving veterans who can't reach out for help, who can't talk to anyone about their problems. All in this society where no one wants to disturb this thin veneer of materialistic paradise. And it's about all these people fighting for the bonds that they do have. Friends, brothers, sons, and all of them breaking free not just of what's causing the suffering, but from the isolation that results from it. And they do that through finding purpose, and they do that through connecting with each other. That is why it feels just so good, so fulfilling, so satisfying, so on point, so organic to this story, when all the different character groups find each other and unite in their purpose. It's why the story's goal feels so noble, because they're not just fighting against a monster, not just fighting against the Demogorgon, they're fighting against the 80s. They're fighting against the society that is refusing to acknowledge the deeper problems that are going on in their society. This malaise of apathy and isolation and quiet suffering that is eating away underneath the surface at the entire world of this time period. And the struggle is if these characters can hold fast to their relationships, if they can find meaning and connection in loving each other, in protecting each other, and embracing all the quirks that would otherwise isolate them as nerds or as freaks or as sexually active women or people struggling with mental health or as gays or as single mothers or kids. That is the deeper solution. That is what will really save them from this fate of becoming human shells. That is what will allow them to triumph not just over the plot, but over the era in which they live. Welcome to the Schneeverse. Oh my gosh, it's cold tonight. Hello everyone, I'm going to keep this short and sweet. If you are a longtime viewer, or if you are a new viewer, if you're a fan of Stranger Things, or Arcane, or Spider-Verse, or you're a writer, or an artist, or just someone who loves having great discussions about media, someone who's passionate about media, I want you to know that you have a home in my community. If you're someone who's interested in any of the perks or community events that I'm throwing up on screen right now, we would love to have you. So consider joining the Schneeverse. Welcome in advance. Back to the video. Okay, but did you catch it before the ad break? Did you catch where the Upside Down fits into all this and how ingenious it is? Great fantasy, as we talked about on this channel, is not just exciting, flashy, wacky, action-packed imagination spewing. Great fantasy is where world-building perfectly maps onto emotional experience. It's where it gives form to real feelings that we have about our lives and about our world. When we achieve something difficult in our mundane lives, it doesn't look how it feels to us. No one notices, no one really gets what we're feeling inside, getting a job or finishing a hard day's work, but inside, it can feel like slaying a dragon. When we experience like an epiphany, like this huge moment of personal development and maturity, that empowerment feels like that scene in Scott Pilgrim where he pulls a flaming sword of self-respect out of his chest. My point is that thousands of stories do dark, creepy, alternate dimensions, and they don't feel like Stranger Things. They don't achieve that level of skin-crawlingly terrifying that we feel in the Nancy scene. But Stranger Things, before we even get to the Upside Down, Stranger Things is a story about a world that is insisting repeatedly that nothing is wrong, when in reality it is rotting from the inside out. A world that is dark is actually not that scary. You know what is scary? It's being in a bright world where you know something horrifying is hiding, and yet the whole world around you is illuminated and everything is out in the open, and look, the body is right here, nothing out of place, but it's what's inside that world that you just know is wrong somehow. Tentacles are not that scary. You know what is scary? Being in a plastic, sterile world that is so lifeless that even what's alive doesn't really feel alive. But meanwhile, everything that's happening to you points not just to life, but to predatory life. You can feel it creeping on the back of your neck. And then as soon as you just scratch the surface, there's endless tentacles grasping at you and a monster trying to devour you. And on that note, monsters are not that scary. You know what is scary? Being told that there is no monster, being told that you're in a safe, sleepy civilization, just like you see all around you, and then suddenly being in a vacant wilderness with a wild man-eater after you. It is not scary to be alone. It is scary to be constantly reassured that you are not alone, because look at all the warm, friendly faces around you. And then one day you wake up in the cold isolation of empty houses, as empty as they've always felt for a suffering outcast like you, and instead of friendly faces of people you know, it's inhuman facelessness. The form of human, but without the humanity. Which is exactly why you always have felt so alone, even in a sea of other people. Stranger Things concretizes the fear that we have when we feel ourselves getting lulled into comfortable numbness by our comfortable world. It doesn't just say, but it shows us, yes, your world is rotting. Yes, there's danger around the corner that you cannot see. Yes, the walls will not protect you. Yes, it's all fake. Yes, everybody is lying to you. Yes, they are all asleep and no one will help you. Yes, you are all alone. That is horrifying. That is what's so scary about the Upside Down, and that's what the characters defeat in season one. By not depending on walls to protect each other, but by depending on each other, by overcoming the disease of isolation of this time period, and instead coming together united as friends who can all protect each other and have real value to offer each other. That is Stranger Things season one. Now, 5 years later, sorry, five seasons later, where does that leave us? So I get the problem. I get the challenge that Stranger Things is facing. It is a real dilemma that part of the horror of the Upside Down that we just described is the horror of discovering it specifically. It's the horror of waking up, of realizing that yes, everyone has been sweeping it all under the carpet for years and years and years, and yes, it did matter. Yes, the world is rotting. Suburbia is not safe because of what all that rot has unleashed, that predatory wilderness that all of you have tried so desperately to ignore. Waking up to that by finding purpose, by overcoming isolation, that is largely complete in season one. That's done. We did that. And it is hard to reawaken the emotions of that by going through the same routine again and again and again. We can relive the memory of what we experienced in season one. We can inch forward a bit more. We can backslide and then re-achieve it. We can have new characters who have to experience it for themselves. But that is fundamentally different than the story about all the characters experiencing all of it at once and accomplishing it for real all at once. That story has happened already. The story's done. So now, what could they have done? Well, if they wanted to do the same formula again, they could have done what Star Wars did. Destroying the Death Star is a real victory at the end of episode 4. But then what happens? Star Wars does want to reuse this formula, and it is an exciting formula, it's an exciting scene. So what does Star Wars do? It radically, radically deepens its themes in episode 5, and then it deepens them even more in episode 6, to the point that it is clear that it was an immature understanding of the Force that led us to believe that the problem was actually solved after episode 4. No, of course the only real victory could come from bringing balance to the Force, by taking the dark and transforming it into the light. It's silly to think we would win this by beating the villain in a ship battle. We need to win the war inside that villain's heart. We need to inspire him to abandon this identity of a galactic commander in favor of the small picture moral choice of being a father, and in doing so rid the galaxy of its very source of hatred. And the Death Star being destroyed in episode 6, that is just a reflection of that. And that is why destroying the Death Star twice worked, but doing it a third time in Force Awakens, that did not work, because there's no deepening of the themes there. Stranger Things has found itself in a similar boat, and in my opinion, unfortunately, they did go the Star Wars route. They are doing the formula again because somehow Palpatine survived. After we defeat the Demogorgon, we get the smaller form, the Demodogs, and then we get the bigger form, the Mind Flayer. And those do work in a superficial way, those work in a plot way, but what do they mean? The Demogorgon used to be this personification of the wild, predatory violence dragging people under that the sleepy citizens of the 80s willfully turned a blind eye to. Smaller pack versions of them, and this giant spider version of it. What is the new element of the allegory that this is bringing out? What new thing is it saying? And then, in season 4, we're not even in American society anymore. We got the Soviets making the prisoners fight the Demogorgons in these gladiator rings. What is this anymore? It's something totally different. In season 1, we got the lights as a direct counter to the darkness of the Upside Down. Season 2, we get the tunnels, which maybe I get were like a there's rot and decay under the surface type thing, but still, I don't know what I'm supposed to feel when Will is drawing them in this delirious trance. I'm not getting anything from Joyce and Bob piecing together that it's a map of Hawkins. And then in season 3, what were the magnets? What was that supposed to be? What was the thing about eating the fertilizer? And then also in season 1, we have our human baddie in the form of Brenner, and we got the whole environment of Hawkins' lab. And that was ingenious. It was like this mask-off version of the 80s facade. If 80s suburban life was sterilized and plastic and lifeless, Hawkins' lab was actually literally sterilized and plastic and lifeless. If 80s families were distant and just had this pretense of normality, Brenner as Papa was this blatant, creepy pretense that was so thin as to be transparent. And we have this child who wasn't just left to her own devices, but neglected to the point of not even having a name, neglected to the point of abuse, and truly, truly isolated, while being told by men in white coats that it was all okay. So you have that whole rich side to the human antagonism in season 1. And now, tell me, what is this supposed to be? Terminator? Just cause 80s? And what about this? Sarah Connor just because 80s? And sure, maybe there's more to this character, maybe we'll see more, but they had 4 episodes to explain. I don't get what she is now. I don't get why there's a military base in the Upside Down. I don't get why there's a Game of Thrones style wall, but all fleshy and tentacly. And I don't mean that I don't get it plot-wise. Sure, fine, whatever, come up with some justification. But what is it saying? What further depths of this elaborate metaphor of the story is it exploring? And I don't know, maybe it's there. It's not clear to me. It feels very haphazard, feels very all over the place. And what I can say for sure is that the Upside Down used to feel like this horrifying reality that your own sterile, safe world was desperate to hide. It was the dark secret of a false society. It was the goosebumps on the back of your neck. And now what it feels like is just an alternate dimension. Just another dark alternate reality like we've seen hundreds of times in hundreds of stories. The Demogorgon used to be this personification of wild predatory violence that the sleepy citizens of the 80s were willfully turning a blind eye to. And now Vecna is what? A wizard? They've had so long to give a simple, coherent idea of what Henry's plan is supposed to be. We've had all of season 4, we've had his whole speech, half of season 5, and I could repeat what he says. I could tell you plot-wise what happened, and I'd probably use a lot of the same words that this video used, a lot of the same motifs of isolation, but just tell me in simple terms. It feels all over the place, and season 1 did not feel like that. Season 1 felt cohesive. Again, I don't get it, maybe it's just me, but tell me if you agree. For me, the Upside Down is not scary anymore, and it's not just because we're desensitized to what it is at this point, it's because I honestly couldn't tell you what it is. It's lost its identity. Now, I'm not saying that Stranger Things has abandoned all of what made it good completely. A lot of the magic of the characters coming together was the way that they were written together, and that still is very, very strong. Season 3, as wacky as it was in a lot of ways, had a lot of great stuff in this exact vein. The invasion of the Body Snatchers / Hive Mind direction, that was just a fantastic new exploration of the Brainless Mind Rot Society idea. Robin and everything she brings to the cast has been excellent. The Billy climax at the end of the season was 10 out of 10 with the isolation, connection, purpose theme. In season 4, Eddie was incredible, Chrissy was incredible. Obviously, the scene with Max was absolutely mind-blowing, and it was all following these themes. But one of the most beautiful examples of all of this has been in this recent batch of episodes of season 5. I'm talking, of course, about Will's Super Saiyan moment, which was an incredible climax that followed the exact principles we've been talking about this entire time. Will is the one character who remains in constant struggle with isolation throughout the whole series up until now. Obviously in season 1, but then once he gets back in season 2 and in season 3, there's still a huge divide between him and his friends. He is still a zombie boy, he is the one queer kid among his social group, he is the only one who wants to play D&D when his friends are obsessed with girls, and then, this is just unfortunate, but he moves away from them and then they get back into D&D, and this whole time, he is being encouraged to do the 80s thing to his own trauma. Internally, he pretends nothing is wrong. Externally, Joyce wants to keep him safe, i.e. prevent him from using what he is now post-trauma to connect with people, to exercise his purpose. Everything he's struggling with throughout all of his seasons can be summed up by this mantra of do I stay or do I go? Go meaning give up, like Vecna tries to get his season 4 victims to do. Stay meaning confront his situation. And how does he do that? What is he finally empowered by? By early memories of him forming these crucial bonds with Mike, with his friends, with his family. That is how Will de-isolates by reconnecting to himself. That is the power we see within him as he disconnects from the hive mind of Vecna and instead connects himself to the hive mind of his friends. That connection and that purpose is how you triumph in Stranger Things, how you triumph over your inner demons, how you triumph over your outer demons, and how you triumph over an apathetic world. That is how you win the 80s. Okay, we'll stop here. Subscribe. There is so much more to dig into with that Will scene. Obviously, a lot to talk about with his sexuality and how Robin's words and behavior and personality guides him. Might make a video on that at some point. I'm also waiting on Squirkle, my analysis partner, who might be making a Will video soon. I want to see what she says. Shouts to her, by the way, for helping me on this video, especially on the Will parts. And shouts to all my patrons and my YouTube members. Special thanks to new high-tier patrons Bandicoot879, Rosie Sue, Reedbuck, Dallas, and Quackswag. I already made my spiel about joining our wonderful community, so I'm just going to let all the names scroll by and bid you a good day. As always, hope you all enjoyed, and thanks for watching.